Don't frighten us by telling us the facts. 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 We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on June 24th, 2018 for release on June 26th and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate and Rachel join me to discuss the UN Special Rapporteur's report on extreme poverty and inequality in the United States. Then we talk about Lush's Spy Cops awareness-raising campaign in the UK. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again in studio this week is Nate. Hey, Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
And joining us on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Nate.
Let's start out by talking this week about a recent United Nations report on poverty in the United States. Nate, I think you brought this topic to the table. What's going on here?
Yeah, so I remember seeing some headlines back in December when the UN Special Rapporteur Phil Alston was doing his tour around the United States. Believe he went to a number of sort of poverty hotspots, including Skid Row in Los Angeles. He went to poor African-American areas in Alabama. He went to Puerto Rico in the aftermath of the hurricane there, and also went to coal country in West Virginia, and sort of released a wide-ranging report sort of distinguishing various types of inequality that exist in the U.S. and the sort of worsening of it under the Trump administration. And so that report came out, and I believe he either recently presented to the UN or is going to do so shortly. So there's a lot in this report that we can look at. I think it also is just worth mentioning. I just saw here Nikki Haley attacks damning UN report on U.S. poverty under Trump. So as is often the case, Nikki Haley is, you know, trying to go after aspects of the UN. I think they just withdrew from the Human Rights Council. So she was very angry about this. She said it was his biased reporting. It is patently ridiculous for the United Nations to examine poverty in America, which prompted puzzlement as Alston carried out his investigation at the informal invitation of the Trump administration. And she's saying, oh, she should have shined a light on countries where governments were causing pain and suffering to their own people. Okay. But she suggested Burundi and Democratic Republic of Congo. But I mean, we're seeing plenty of human rights abuses in the United States as well. So,
yeah, there were some interesting quotes from the Los Angeles Times interview with this special rapporteur about his travels across the country. You mentioned the, I think, four specific regions of particular note. But to that point that you just mentioned about the government, in talking about Puerto Rico and West Virginia, he says, I'm told I'm not supposed to use the term, but certainly the conditions in Puerto Rico were very much third world. I've met people who are living without any real access to the basic services that we've come to expect. Government is just not an actor. There's no provision of social protections at all. I went to West Virginia, one of the states that did not take the Medicaid expansion, where they have relatively low rates of health insurance, and I saw the extent to which very few government services are provided for people generally, not just health, but access to the internet and so on. As was explained to me by government officials, if we propose any additional spending in the budget, it's completely out of the question. It's not going to be accepted by the legislature.
Yeah, so that's part of, I guess, one example. Also, I'm just looking at this Guardian article about Haley. There was a response by 20 prominent members in Congress, including Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, John Lewis, sort of taking on Nikki Haley there. And basically, Bernie sort of was talking in his, you know, normal thing. More than top three people own more than half the wealth of the bottom half. We can and must do much better than that. And sort of going after Sanders, or going after Haley in general on this sort of hypocrisy. There was also that video recently of Haley trying, like, begging other representatives at the UN to try to back up the UN or the US, I think, measure on Gaza, or trying to, like, not condemn Israel, and basically she got shut down. So it's been a kind of a rough time for her at the UN recently, but we should probably dive into the report. So
yeah, Rachel, what did you want to highlight from all of this?
So I wanted to highlight that middle-class Americans kind of think they're immune from these slashing of the social safety net. As Alston mentioned, Trump's assault bodes ill for society as a whole. The proposed slashing of social protection benefits will affect the middle classes every bit as much as the poor. And I think a lot of that ties into how many people think they're part of the middle class, even if they actually aren't. I'm not entirely sure where the lines are, but a lot of people who are pretty solidly working class tend to think of themselves as middle class. And even people who think of who are actually upper class kind of think of themselves as middle class. So I think if we slash the social safety net programs, it's kind of a race to the bottom at that point. As the bottom drops out and working class Americans kind of fall into this poverty, it has a dragging effect. And so people in the middle class who may think they're safe now will actually be dragged down with this growing inequality. So I think it's definitely a warning for everybody, not just working class people or people on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale.
Yeah, there was the that Federal Reserve survey that I think was mentioned in this report, basically saying 4 out of 10 Americans could not cover an emergency expense of $400 without borrowing money or selling possessions. So it's probably not a huge middle class if 4 in 10 cannot afford $400 emergency.
Now, Rachel, an article that you had brought to the table that we had not been able to work into any previous episodes was about the issue of inequality in Idaho specifically. I don't think that I hadn't seen Idaho as a focus area in this UN report, but certainly there's a lot going on near you on this similar front about serious wealth gaps and extreme poverty. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
As you mentioned, the Bloomberg analyzed Census Bureau data and came out with a report on growing inequality and where that growing inequality is growing the fastest. So they looked at the top and bottom quintiles of households. And in the Boise metropolitan area, the wealth gap widened by $44,400 from 2011 to 2016. And that is such a huge amount that Boise went from number 76 on Bloomberg's ranking of disparities to number 7. So it's growing really rapidly. It's kind of scary, especially for housing. So let's see, by 2016, the top 20%, the average income is $182,000. And meanwhile, the bottom quintile, it's stagnated around $12,000, which is a huge difference. And it's really taken away opportunities for housing from the poorest Boiseans in this area. Housing rates have risen. They've skyrocketed dramatically because people are able to buy houses with cash, usually coming from California, where they can sell their houses for about $1 million, move into the area and buy in cash at $300,000 or $400,000. And even like start bidding against each other and driving housing rates up dramatically. And that leaves the poor people with no place to live and struggling really, really heavily and getting pushed out to the edges of the metropolitan area. You can have commutes into Boise from like hundreds of miles away. And that's a daily occurrence, which is very, very sad for people who want to live in Boise but just can't afford to, because it's become an untenable situation.
I think there were a lot of contrasts highlighted in the UN report, you know, the sort of like the point about people being kind of side by side with, you know, the people who are doing great and probably moving in from other areas, the people doing really poorly. That was highlighted in the overview section of the report. It says it's one of the world's wealthiest societies, a global leader in many areas, and a land unsurpassed technological and other forms of innovation. Its corporations are global trendsetters, its civil society is vibrant and sophisticated, and its higher education system leads the world. But its immense wealth and expertise stand in shocking contrast with the conditions in which the vast numbers of its citizens live. About 40 million live in poverty, 18.5 million in extreme poverty, and 5.3 million live in third world conditions of absolute poverty. It has the highest youth poverty rate in the OECD and the highest infant mortality rates among comparable OECD states. Its citizens live shorter and sicker lives compared to those living in all other rich democracies. Eradicable tropical diseases are increasingly prevalent, and it has the world's highest incarceration rate, one of the lowest levels of voter registrations among OECD countries, and the highest obesity levels in the developed world. And then they talk about some very specific things, but the Alabama stuff was particularly interesting to me. There's a lot of focus in the report about the issue of felon disenfranchisement in Alabama and sort of the impacts that that has on government policies and everything. It also says, in Alabama and West Virginia, a high proportion of the population is not served by public sewerage and water supply services, contrary to the assumption in most developed countries that such services should be extended by the government systematically and eventually comprehensively to all areas. Neither state was able to provide figures as to the magnitude of the challenge or details of any planned government response. So they're not even really keeping track of it in these states. Again, not a huge surprise. But something that I think came up a lot in the aftermath of the Flint, Michigan water disaster was the point that in places like South Carolina or Alabama, in the so-called Black Belt, the areas that are very heavily African American, generally associated with the most with the same areas that historically before the American Civil War had the highest levels of slaves per capita. And a lot of folks did not move away after that and then became kind of trapped into the sharecropping system, so they just remain there. These are these areas that are still or formerly agricultural areas in the Deep South, extreme poverty, almost no government response there. And you have, you know, the thing in Flint, Michigan was obviously a horrible situation that the government perpetrated to save some money. And by just changing the water policies there, but like there are these areas in Alabama and South Carolina and so on that are just kind of like that all the time, permanently, forever, with no end in sight and no real attention on it. As the UN report noted, you have open sewage flowing in some places as if it was, you know, the slums of a city in Nigeria or India or something like that. And there's also, I know, a lot of heavy metals contamination in the soil in a lot of places, in addition to the various, like, you know, fecal related bacterias and things that are a serious threat to people. Nate?
Yeah, the report also notes that poor rural communities, highlighting both West Virginia as well as Puerto Rico, are often exposed to these toxic waste, including coal ash, but they almost rarely benefit from any sort of extraction profits. So a lot of times they're just being subjected to the contaminants, as you mentioned, like rare metals and all these different types of things that increase cancer rates and everything like that. So that is part of it. I think the report also mentioned San Francisco. We visited there. We were just talking about sort of the inequality in San Francisco. We've mentioned that before on the show. Honestly, when I was struck, I was going through all of this report, and a lot of this is just stuff we've talked about on the show. This is just like right in our wheelhouse in terms of talking about, you know, criminalization of poverty, Walmart welfare explicitly calls out Walmart, you know, talking about various, the myth of welfare fraud, bans on panhandling, rough sleeping, mentioned that the Skid Row does not meet the standards set by the UN High Commissioner on Refugees, talking about various challenges faced by indigenous peoples, including underfunded departments that are supposed to deal with them, and the paternalistic attitudes that are contrary to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, various non-recognized tribes. So even things like lack of high-speed internet in rural areas or food deserts, lack of public transportation. This is a pretty comprehensive look at the challenges we're facing in the U.S. right now, and sort of it goes over everything, including various gender inequalities, racial inequalities, and just highlighting how poverty is a political choice that has been sort of exacerbated by the Trump administration's tax cuts, $1.5 trillion. So this is pretty much all here, and this is sort of the types of things that we normally discuss on the show.
Yeah, in the conclusions and recommendations section, obviously I can't read all the stuff that he says, but just to kind of go over the key points, one, decriminalize being poor. Two, acknowledge the plight of the middle class and basically the need for government action. Three, acknowledge the damaging consequences of extreme inequality. Four, recognize a right to health care. Five, get real about taxes, basically talking about the fact that you can't just do this stuff without ever raising taxes, especially given how low the taxes tend to be in a lot of places, or at least as he emphasizes how low the taxes on the wealthy are. So a very interesting report, and not all that long. He notes at the beginning of the report that there's a very strict word limit that he had to abide by. So this is actually only, I think, about 20 pages long. We'll have all the links to that at arsenalfordemocracy.com, of course, as we do every week, so you can check that out. And then we'll have a few of these other articles talking about the report and interviewing him, etc. Rachel, your closing thoughts on this topic before we move on?
I just wanted to highlight, like what Nate said, this is a lot of the stuff in this report is stuff we've talked about before, eliminating bail bonds. So there aren't two justice systems, one for people who can afford bail and one for those who can't. It also mentioned the importance of dental care, which we have touched on here. I think it's not highlighted in the report, but I kind of followed along with the rapporteur. There was a series in The Guardian, and I think when he went to West Virginia, he went to one of those healthcare fairs where a whole bunch of medical providers, dental providers, vision providers, all kind of descend on like a fairgrounds and try to see as many people as possible in like a long weekend. And a lot of people had to have like teeth extracted. They had abscesses. They just couldn't save the teeth. And a lot of that highlights or exacerbates unemployability because a lack of teeth is associated with being like lazy, shiftless, a drug user. And so that really decreases your chances of getting a job in the future. So I just wanted to highlight that part as well.
Yeah, so many things that we could talk about and go into more depth, but as you both have pointed out, we've also talked about a lot of these specific points on previous episodes, so we'll refer folks back to that. Let's talk now, switching gears to a different country, about this is from a few weeks ago, kind of at this point, but still ongoing developments happening. The Lush Spy Cops ad campaign in the United Kingdom, which was just, I mean, I'm not really contextually aware of the thing before this was in the news, but which I guess was mission accomplished for them in raising awareness of it, but sort of baffling to see this cosmetics company doing this. Rachel, do you want to kind of walk us through the basics of like what this company in the UK is, what this ad campaign was like referring to? I think you were commenting last night when we were discussing in preparation for this episode that it's very strange to see a cosmetics company doing this, and it's almost as if they're like actually some sort of a social justice activism network that's masquerading as a company.
Right. So I think we're all kind of familiar with Lush as like the purveyor of bath bombs and like fragrances and bath stuff mostly. But they have started at the beginning of June, they started highlighting undercover police officers who had infiltrated activist groups and oftentimes fathered children, had really long ongoing relationships with women in these activist organizations, and then just kind of disappear. So I believe in 2015, it kind of came out that this was policy for the Metropolitan Police, and it just kind of disappeared after a while. And so I think this is a way for the owners of Lush to highlight that we're still thinking about this. We still need answers as to why this was policy. A lot of the backlash happened because people thought that the company was attacking the police in general. They had slogans that said the police are paid to lie and police have crossed the line. And even the Home Secretary, Sajid Javid, said that never thought I would see a mainstream British retailer running a public advertising campaign against our hardworking police. This is not the responsible way to make a point. However, Lush is saying they're just targeting the spy cops, quote unquote, policy, and not attacking the police at large. So I believe they had the signs up for a week or two, took it down, but just a few days ago, they decided to resume this campaign because they don't see it as complete yet until more people are aware and until some answers from this inquiry are published. I think the Parliament is kind of hoping this will all blow over and that they can release their results in private and not really release it to the public. But I think this Lush campaign is trying to pull that out into the light and make sure the inquiry results are publicized and that everybody is aware of what happened. And I think they started this policy in like the 60s or 70s, just infiltrating some of those like leftist organizations and activist groups that were kind of coming out of the turmoil of the 60s. And
not just infiltrating the organizations, but infiltrating people's lives in a really fundamental way.
Sort of like the British COINTELPRO type.
Yeah,
of
yeah. I think that's exactly. Probably the closest analogy there. And certainly, like, this is, I guess, not the first time that the company has done various sort of protest type things that are unrelated to their actual brand and products. So they've run campaigns against Guantanamo and fracking.
Drones.
Did some stuff related to the Grenfell disaster.
Supported Palestine, Black Lives Matter.
Interesting Guardian point is that they do have shops and make a profit in Saudi Arabia. And so that, like, does lead to some questions about maybe, you know, I guess it's that goes back to the core point of any of these things, which is, like, you can't really count on these capitalist enterprises to, like, truly be activist and left wing or whatever. They're always going to have some pretty serious compromises for the sake of making profits, etc. The founder of the company, he said that he was homeless for a while after his stepfather kicked him out of the house when he was like a teenager. And so, you know, he had been struggling with that as a teen and kind of as a result learned a lot about people at the bottom rung of society's ladder and their struggles and things like that. Probably had some encounters with the police himself, it sounds like. And you know, that he said that is sort of motivated a lot of his charitable work and like trying to give directly to not just these activist groups, but also give directly in small amounts of money to like just poor people who need a little bit of help. Because, you know, that can really make all the difference, even if it's a small amount. But it was just, I don't know, he seems like an interesting guy, but this is just sort of, I think it's particularly noteworthy that after all these different causes that they've supported, you know, and raised hell about, that the thing that really like drew all the ire and backlash more than any of these other things was saying that some number of police officers who objectively, according to all the reports and everything, had done a bunch of terrible and deeply unethical things, apparently with government approval, that this was seen as some sort of systemic attack on police and that was totally unacceptable and they had to raise a lot of like problems about, I don't know, just flip out about it basically. Nate?
Yeah, so I think there was some support there was a letter signed by various politicians, union officials, lawyers, and people who were affected by the spy cops, because there was a sort of hashtag flush lush sort of backlash, and there were ex-police people sort of like intimidating them, things like that.
Yeah, but they said employees were getting followed home from
right.
the stores and
so,
stuff.
So, yeah, I mean, that's the situation there. But so Doreen Lawrence, who was a victim of undercover spy cop, has been heading up the We Stand With Lush movement. Two former wives of undercover spy cops have also defended the Lush movement. The woman's husbands had extramarital affairs while undercover, and they feel betrayed by the task force's actions. One said, Lush's campaign has done more to publicize the issue in a weekend than a public inquiry, which started 3 years ago, which is also probably true because we probably wouldn't have heard about this as much otherwise. They're also joined by the son of an undercover police officer who's abandoned as a child so his father could keep his true identity secret. I am grateful to Lush for bringing undercover policing back to the spotlight, says the son, seeing Sajid Javid use it as to try to win favor with the police by calling on Lush to withdraw their campaign has really upset me. And this sort of goes into sort of the shut up and dribble controversies, entertainers, athletes. But for some of the visions, it's been encouraging to see a brand like Lush get involved in the movement. It's our view is that the amount of public money spent to date for such little progress is a far greater concern than the Lush campaign, explain ex-wives of former spy cops. So it seems like they're probably frustrated that this wasn't getting anywhere, and now it did because of this sort of very bold advertising campaign.
Yeah, I think it said the inquiry has cost £10.3 million already in these 3 years, and very little to show for it at this point.
You can never really trust these official Crown right. inquiries really anyway, so
yeah, we have seen that we have done nothing wrong and we're totally innocent because we're the ones investigating. So yeah, very, I would take it with a huge grain of salt if whenever they do come out with their results.
Yeah, and especially when it's like the High Court, it's like this is not separate from the Crown and the
right the policing system is part of the whole thing, right? Like it's fundamentally fundamentally it's a self-investigation, like any of these things, and those never work out.
Hutton inquiry and all that stuff. So
yeah, well, I mean, wasn't there that there was like the Chilcot inquiry regarding Chilcot, the Iraq War,
that and got that got a little bit of press
yeah. because it was such a high profile thing, but like even that just kind of faded pretty quickly. But yeah, I do think it's interesting that the thing that finally like caused a bunch of people to freak out at this company is them criticizing some cops who, again, objectively did pretty terrible things. That's not really in dispute. So, okay.
But it just shows a sort of reflexive Blue Lives Matter type of response where it's like any criticism, even of like fathering children while undercover.
And then abandoning them.
That's too far apparently now. So.
All right, well, that brings us to the end of our time today. Rachel, thanks so much for being on the line.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
And Nate, thanks for being here in studio.
Thanks, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.